Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the German Parliament's overwhelming vote to approve a resolution calling the mass killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks in 1915 genocide. Richard Hovhannessian, a professor of Armenian and Near East history and chair of modern Armenian history at the University of California, Los Angeles, joins us to assess the historical significance of this move by Germany, Turkey's strongest ally in Europe and its ally during World War I when the Armenian genocide occurred. We'll discuss Turkey's decades-long dogged resistance to widespread calls from more than 20 countries and Pope Francis to recognize the killings as genocide and Germany's role as Turkey's ally during World War I when its military did nothing to stop the genocide, a guilt that Germany acknowledged today while Turkey doubled down on denial and withdrew its ambassador as President Erdogan threatened retaliation. Then we'll get a perspective on the political tightrope Germany is walking with Turkey as diplomatic relations are increasingly strained by Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. At the same time, Berlin needs Turkey's help in resolving the refugee crisis, with more than 1.1 million migrants having settled in Germany last year. Andre Markowitz, the Karl W. Deutsch Professor of German Studies at the University of Michigan, joins us to discuss how much the deal struck between Chancellor Merkel and Erdogan in March to take back migrants arriving on Greek islands in exchange for money and visa-free travel for Turks in Europe is now in jeopardy. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the new federal regulations for payday lenders proposed today by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch, who served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee. We will discuss whether the new rules will be sufficient to stop the predatory practices of loan sharks, whose $38 billion industry rips off 12 million poor and unsuspecting Americans every year under the protection of our cash and carry Congress. And joining us now is Richard Hovhannessian, who is a professor of Armenian and Near East history and holder of the Armenian Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Armenian History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of many books, including The Armenian Genocide, Cultural and Ethical Legacies, and Remembrance and Denial, The Case of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hovhannessian.
Thank you very much. And just to clarify, past holder and now working with the Shoah Foundation on Armenian survivor testimony.
Well, thank you for that correction. And I imagine that today's move by the German parliament, isn't that an historic move and a great step forward?
Indeed. And actually, personally, I'm rather surprised. It's been very, very long in the coming. And there were many forces that worked against it. But I'm at least pleased that they took the moral high ground in this instance and acknowledged the genocide, and in so doing also the unfortunate role of the Kaiser Wilhelm's government during World War I, who's at the very least played a role in covering up what was occurring.
So why do you think it took Germany so long, France, Italy, Canada, Argentina, the Pope, Russia? A number of countries have called for Turkey to recognize the genocide of the Armenians. Why did it take Germany so long?
Well, obviously, one is complicit in crime. Indeed, it was a crime. One doesn't readily admit to it. They did so. I think they were rather forced to do so when Germany was occupied border to border in World War II, and that was an enormous burden for them to carry, which they're still carrying. And as in many countries, including the United States of America, which acknowledged the Armenian genocide many, many times at the time of the Wilson administration in recent years, is dances around the word genocide, doesn't want to use the word because of geopolitical, economic, military considerations. After all, Turkey is a key NATO player, and when it puts the screws on and says, you talk about this and then you're going to bear the consequences. There are some who don't want to stand up to the blackmail.
Well, I think President Obama faltered recently, didn't he, when a committee of Congress wanted to use the word genocide. This was on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. They endorsed it despite the objections from the White House.
Yes, but you know, this is also true of the Bush administration and the Clinton administration. When Congress shows any disposition toward reaffirming, I don't say recognizing because it's been recognized a number of times, but reaffirming in modern times the Armenian genocide, the executive branch steps in with the Department of State, with the Pentagon, and with all the pressure that they have, and even the personal intervention of the president. You know, presidents don't like personally to intervene. They'd rather that others do it, but Clinton himself was forced personally to intervene to block further consideration of such a thing. But in this case, Germany and Merkel's party, along with the Greens, and I think it's really significant that one of the main sponsors of the German resolution was an ethnic Turk, German, but of ethnic Turkish origins, who said, you know, this is enough, that Turkey needs to be encouraged to acknowledge its own past, just as Germany has acknowledged it and become a better country for it. And I listened to an interview of this man, Cem Özdürün, who made the point that there are really two narratives in Turkey. One is the official narrative, and the other one is the popular narrative that is known by the people, and all of whom talk about, on the side and in private, about what occurred in the times of their grandparents and great-grandparents, and some of them even admitting to the fact that one of their grandparents or great-grandparents had been an Armenian girl or even an Armenian boy who had been Turkified and but still had not forgotten the fact that what their origins were.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Hovhannisyan, who is a former professor of Armenian and Near East history and holder of the Armenian Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Armenian History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's now with the Shoah Foundation and is the author of many books, including The Armenian Genocide, Cultural and Ethical Legacies, and Remembrance and Denial, The Case of the Armenian Genocide. So back in 2010, when the House Foreign Affairs Committee took up the word genocide, Turkey withdrew its ambassador. It's done the same thing today from Germany, withdrawing its ambassador. Do you see an escalation here, or will
this is a pattern by Turkey. Any time that a government, whether it's the Vatican government or the Austrian government or any other government or the French government acknowledges the Armenian genocide, they withdraw their ambassador and they make some fuss. They even cancel contracts and so forth. But, you know, apparently Turkey needs these governments as much as or more than these governments need Turkey. And then after a while, they sort of quietly return to the scene. And therefore, I think it's even more shameful for the United States to give in to such pressure when, in fact, certainly the United States and its support is more important for Turkey probably than vice versa. And also I think it's very significant, getting back to the resolution, is that it is in the way, you know, all of these resolutions and acknowledgments of the Armenian genocide never insist on reparations or any restitution of that kind. So they're basically are moralistic statements with no other teeth, but nonetheless, for a victim group who has suffered genocide and who has suffered the continuing trauma of denial for a century, it's very soothing to have these statements. Nothing is going to change except that hopefully the historical record will be set straight in the long run, and hopefully the Turkish government will come to realize that its campaign of denial, for which it spends billions of dollars over the years, would be better have been placed with doing acts of restitution and reparations rather than that, including it still blockades that what little bit of Armenia remains today in the Caucasus. It's like 11,000 square miles is what's left of it, mostly mountainous. But even there, they've blockaded the government, the country. They don't open borders, which is against all international conventions. So, you know, they can take some measures to help rectify the situation. Germany was complicit, mostly as a silent bystander, not wanting to risk alienating an ally during World War I, because the Ottoman Empire was an ally of Germany. But there actually were several German officers who participated in the deportations and even the bombardment of city quarters where the Armenians had put up barricades to try to defend themselves from being deported and killed. So there is a German role here that the Germans need themselves to face as they have faced the Holocaust. I think this is a step in that direction.
Well, indeed, Richard Hovhaniassian, those very historical facts were debated today in the German parliament before the resolution was taken with this overwhelming vote, where the country effectively absolved itself of the guilt, which is entire mystifying to me that Turkey doesn't want to take that path because it's clearly a much healthier path to take. And but then, of course, you've got in Erdogan, you've got this authoritarian, increasingly authoritarian leader who just is lashing out all over the place. He's reignited a war with the Kurds in order to take over more executive authority. And in fact, he has passed a law that strips of opposition politicians of immunity. So it's a horrible situation that's happening in Turkey today.
It is indeed, and very worrisome. And when governments do not face up to their past wrongs, they're right in a position to repeat them. And I think this is very much evident in Turkey today. And rather than trying to resolve issues in a peaceful manner that can give some satisfaction to the aggrieved parties, one is the use of force, and I won't call it genocide, but extreme violence that is taking place. Denial is not an easy phenomenon to fathom. Part of it is psychological, that we're such good people and we're so kind and hospitable, we could never do anything like that, and my parents or grandparents could never be killers, they're so loving. So part of it is psychological, but a great deal of it is also economic. There was a total transfer of huge Armenian wealth, collective wealth, both from a point of view of the establishment, that is the patriarchate, schools, churches, and so forth, and personal wealth, because the Armenians happened to become, like the Greeks and like the Jews of the Ottoman Empire, among the leading professional and merchant classes. And so what was taken away absolutely with no restitution whatsoever, and it amounts today in the billions and billions and billions of dollars. And of course, if Turkey admits to the genocide, I expect that some people will ask, well, then what are you going to do about it? Or what about all this wealth? And many Armenians, even though it's for now four generations, there's a number of Armenians who still have property deeds, although they were declared null and void by the Turkish government. Nonetheless, that was under duress, and I would say there's a strong moral argument for the restitution of people who and goods. And so I think that the Turkish governments, not only Erdogan, but all the governments that preceded him, were really quite afraid of the economic aspect of this, aside from this attitude that the world really doesn't understand us. The world is all against us. We've always, it's the old going back to the concept of the Dar al-Harb, the land of the infidels, that we still have the rhetoric we hear of today. And it does resonate, as even in current-day Germany, where a part of this is there and sentiments regarding interracial and interethnic relations that go on there.
Well, just to touch on the history, though, the genocide was orchestrated and ordered by the so-called Young Turks, which is an officers' movement that has seized power in 1908 in Turkey as the Ottoman Empire was crumbling and the country was suffering military defeats in World War One. Yeah. They called themselves the Committee of Unity and Progress. And they ended the war on Germany's side in 1914. But Turkish propaganda at the time presented the Armenians as saboteurs and a pro-Russian fifth column.
Yes.
But interesting enough that after the war in 1919-1920, the Ottomans several of these people were put on trials, a local governor and the Young Turks top triumvirate, the three pashas, they'd already fled abroad. They were sent to death in absentia. So some kind of acknowledgement was made. So why have the successive Turkish governments even denied the fact that they sort of accepted guilt back in 1920?
Well, the acknowledgements took place immediately after World War One, when Turkey had been defeated by the successor governments and anti-Young Turk governments that took power after the end of the war. Military courts martial. These are significant. They're Turkish courts that condemned. It was not like Nuremberg, where it was Allied courts. These were Turkish courts that condemned to death in absentia because they were not in the country. The leaders of the Young Turks, interestingly enough, many of whom had fled to Germany, and the key architect of the genocide, whose name was Talat, actually was hunted down by young Armenian vengeance seekers who had, since he had been condemned to death and they had not been extradited, they actually tracked him down and assassinated Talat in 1921 on the streets of Berlin, and the young assassin was then acquitted. And you had very major German individuals, such as Johannes Lepsius, a major missionary, who had tried to help the Armenians during the course of the genocide, who had tried to intervene with the German government to no avail. As a matter of fact, his reports, along with the reports of, there were many diplomats, German diplomats, who also were reporting on what was going on. These were all suppressed by the German government at the time. They didn't want their own people to know. And so they were complicit in that they repeated the Turkish arguments of whether the Armenians were real or potential supporters of the Allies, of our enemies, and so the preventive measures had to be taken against them. And so we had people like Johannes Lepsius and others who came to the defense of this young man, whose name was Telerian, who had tracked down Talat in Berlin to carry out the verdict. So there was this, but the fact is that was a very short period. There was a Turkish rise of a Turkish nationalist movement in 1920-21 that became very successful, led by a very dynamic, charismatic leader whose name was Mustafa Kemal, later to become known as Ataturk and the founder of the Turkish Republic. And when the Allied powers, the Western powers, made their peace with him, because they were afraid that Turkey, if they didn't do that, Turkey would become Bolshevik, would become communist. Their main fear in the 1920s was the fear, the Red Fear. And so they didn't want Turkey to go in over into that side. So they made their peace with Mustafa Kemal. They swept all their wartime promises about restitution and punishment of the Turks and freeing the Armenian people forever from Turkish domination. They swept all those under the carpet. And when you break your promises, you don't want to be reminded of them. And that's one of the reasons that the Western powers for so long, I'm putting aside Germany now because Germany wasn't a lie, but all the others, France, even Great Britain to this day, the United States and others who made all these pledges, really don't want to be reminded of them, and they prefer to have political amnesia, which they demonstrated for decades because Turkey became that very important crossroads, sitting, straddling on one of the most strategic areas of the world, and still is one of the most strategic countries of the world. When you look at the wars in Syria and Iraq and the issues in Iran, you can understand its key importance. And the leaders of Turkey have played upon that in order to suppress memory of or discussion of the Armenian genocide. But still, you know, it's interesting, after 100 years, it's still an issue. For most of us, 100 years is so ancient history, we don't know what, you know, who was what. But this is an issue that has not gone away and is an albatross on the neck of the Turkish authorities. And people like Erdogan, who are so arrogant on these issues, are only aggravating the situation and bringing a probably greater attention to it and sustaining it among the victimized peoples. And, of course, the victims were not only Armenians. The Assyrians, the Greeks, and others were victimized. Basically, all the Christian populations ultimately were expelled from what had been the Ottoman Empire. There were a very significant percentage of the population before 1914, and through the 1920s, 1930s, and right down until the 1950s, they were compelled to leave or expelled, so that Turkey has become this country of 99% Muslim. But even then, the diversity among the Muslim populations has not given peace and security to them, as revival of national sentiment among the Kurds has really complicated. You know, the sure. Turkish strategists miscalculated. They thought that because the Kurds were a very backward people, they had no alphabet, they didn't have really a literature and so forth, that they could eventually, since they were Muslim, they could absorb them into the Turkish nation. And for decades, they wouldn't even allow the word Kurd to be used. They referred to the Kurdish people as mountainous Turks.
Right.
And denied them education, their own radio programs.
Right, and now of course, Erdogan has reignited a civil war with the Kurds in order to take more executive authority. I'm afraid we've run out of time.
In any case, I think it's a historic day, and I'm really glad that the German Parliament and through them the German people are coming to terms with this very, very black page in there and in human history.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Hovhaniassian. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Hovhaniassian, who's a former professor of Armenian and Near East history and holder of the Armenian Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Armenian History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's now with the Shoah Foundation and is the author of many books, including The Armenian Genocide, Cultural and Ethical Legacies, and Remembrance and Denial, The Case of the Armenian Genocide. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into how Germany is walking a tightrope with Turkey. Look at me, I just can't believe what they've done to me. We could never get free. I just wanna be. Look at me, I just can't believe what they've done to me. We could never get free. I just wanna dream. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andre Markowitz, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He's written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Markowitz.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
And Andre, this vote today, an overwhelming vote in the German parliament with the Social Democrats, the Christian Democrats, and all the Greens weighing in. And it was, as our first guest, Professor Hovhannissian, pointed out, there was, I think it was brought to the floor by a Turkish German citizen who's a member of parliament.
Yeah, Cemil Demir, huh?
But nevertheless, you know, the Erdogan, the president, has reacted. They've pulled the Turkish ambassador, and he's making threats that there's going to be something, another shoe is going to drop. So how does Germany walk this tightrope in the sense that it is obviously diplomatic relations are increasingly strained because of Erdogan's authoritarian behavior? But at the same time, Germany needs Turkey's help in resolving the refugee crisis, with more than 1.1 million migrants having been settled in Germany last year alone.
I actually think Erdogan, it's all bluster. I'm not quite sure what shook he has to drop. I totally agree with the previous speaker that what I heard that of the analysis. This was long overdue, especially in the case of Germany. What will Erdogan do? He might, withraw his ambassador for longer. Will he declare war on Germany? Yes, he may actually expel some of the refugees, which I actually see as a much deeper problem, and it's really a European issue. And Merkel really kind of bailed out conveniently with this Turkish option because she just could not prevail on the other Europeans to pull their weight. But I just don't see what Turkey, what Trump card it has to hurt Germany in this. It's sort of, yes, of course, there's a lot of demonstrations and all this, and shy of the Turkish population in Germany, which is by far the largest in Europe, that could be a bit of a restive situation. But there, too, I don't see any serious consequences for Germany in this.
Well, Chancellor Merkel did make a deal with Erdogan back in March to take back the migrants arriving on the Greek islands, particularly on Lesbos, in exchange for a lot of money from the EU and visa-free travel for Turks in Europe. Though, so you don't see that deal being in jeopardy? It seems
what can he do? Does he now want the Turks not to travel visa-free to Europe? The only Trump card that Erdogan has in this is to renege and basically open the and let the refugees swamp Europe, is really, I think, more of an issue for Europe. But that's a different topic. I was very much against this whole deal with Turkey because it was a kind of very cheap cop-out, which, and also basically very, very temporary. I just don't see it's bluster. It's all bluster. It's all Erdogan. It's, really befitting him. What really saddens me is that there seems to be a strong consensus in Turkey over this. And this is always the case over issues of nationalism. Parties that otherwise are divided are in most cases come together. And this seems to be the case here as well, that almost everybody condemned this. And, I know a lot of Turkish intellectuals who are still very, very wary about calling the Armenian genocide, a genocide. So this goes deeper. I think that's the issue for me. Not that the Islamists and Erdogan are upset about this, of course, but that this is probably quite. If we were to take a survey of the, opinion survey of the Turkish population about this, I'm sure that an overwhelming majority condemns this.
Yeah, but these are the same people, by the way, that Erdogan is going after. He's jailing journalists, he's jailing intellectuals, he's jailing professors, yeah. He's passing all of these ludicrous laws that you can't insult him. He went after a comedian.
Yeah.
He's...
Well, on this issue, I totally agree with you. Please, you won't find any sympathy for Erdogan with me in any situation, but I'm saying that on this issue, I think I'm not sure every intellect, but on this issue, his leeway and legitimacy is a lot higher than on many others.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrei Markovits, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. So, but if there is, for example, in effect, Turkey they've been carrying quite a burden for some time with the refugees. Now, some people say, well, they're very cynical. They'd like to keep the Syrian population there to squeeze out the Kurdish population along that
yes.
strip on the border.
Yes.
And you know that he's declared war on the Kurds and reignited that war. So who knows what he's really up to. But nevertheless, you have to give Turkey credit for having taken care of a lot of refugees, have spent a lot of money. Now, of course, they've been compensated, and the refugee flow is huge. The country, Syria, the civil war is not ending, and more and more people are simply getting bottled up, and the people that are being turned away on the Greek islands and held in big pens there aren't too happy. Mm-hmm. So there isn't an overall European solution, and this problem.
No, but that has nothing to do with what the German Bundestag did.
I understand, but all I was going to say was that this problem could be reignited in a heartbeat.
Yes, it can, right. And it would anyway. But I think everything you said, I totally agree with. That his interests have a lot to do with Syria, with the Kurds, all kinds of other facets which have very little to do with ultimately just a symbolic act. That's what this was. I mean, it wasn't, and I think, way too late. But basically, all this was a symbolic act, which of course is very important in politics. But I don't see any. I don't see Turkey having any leverage over Germany in any of this, and so. I actually would have even counseled Frau Merkel to have been there. I mean, she wasn't there, was conveniently, I don't know, busy in some other commitment. And the German foreign minister was in Argentina. So a bit of a cop-out there, but I understand. But I don't see any, this was, I think, a fairly cost-free act by the German Bundestag.
So then we should separate the refugee issue out, you think? Because, my understanding is, I don't know what the percentage of the German population are unsettled by increasing emigration from the Middle East, which includes Turkey, but specifically is mostly Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But today, the BND, Germany's FBI
right.
Arrested three Syrians who are about to, set off bombs. We see what just happened in Austria with a real nail biter of who would be president, a sort of neo-Nazi versus a nice professor from the Green Party, and that was a nail biter. So there is some big strains going on in Europe.
Big time. And the party systems of the post-war era are in many ways fraying and disintegrating. Absolutely. But that, again, in some ways, has nothing to do with this particular act of the Bundestag. That the German population is very wary of immigrants, all populations are. No one likes newcomers, you know, whether that's a club or a team or anything. And so the Germans are no different from anybody else. In fact, if anything, the Germans were immensely, you know, magnanimous in terms of accepting as many as they did. But of course, there are costs to this, and there is a far right in Germany, in two sort of institutions. But beyond that, you know, there is a strong sentiment within Frau Merkel's CDU, and especially its Bavarian sister party CSU, which wants a stop of this, and maybe even some repatriation. Or so clearly, in fact, I always have argued that Frau Merkel really, for the last year, has basically governed oddly with on this issue for sure, with a social democratic green coalition rather than with the backing of her own party. And so this is a precarious situation. It's as you rightly say, all over Europe. In Austria, FPÖ almost won its presidential, you know, the presidential candidate, and the party would just got even stronger. It already was strong, of course, from the late 80s on, in the 90s under Jörg Haider, the first really charismatic far-right politician in Europe, who was, by the way, also very popular in Germany. And repeatedly people said, oh, why don't we have sort of on the right said, why don't we have a Haider? So that exists. And some of this nationalism will play out in the impending Euro soccer tournament that will start in France next Friday. You know, these things exist, but I don't see this act by the German Bundestag aggravating this or creating a situation that we didn't have already.
So just in the last minute then, the relations with Turkey and Germany are very substantial, as Merkel pointed out today, and the ties are quite deep. Does the average German-Turk, are they sympathetic to the Bundestag, or are they sympathetic to
Erdogan? No, the average German-Turk probably is not. I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen the data on this, but the average German-Turk is not, probably will be upset or is upset, but not upset enough to leave Germany, not upset to you know, sever ties with this, will not stop from remitting huge amounts of money back home. So I don't see on the ground any kind of substantial change in, as you rightly say, the close ties between Turkey and Germany, and also the Turco-Germans, like Cem Özdemir, who, of course, a green parliamentarian, who also voted for this and has repeatedly spoken about the Armenian situation as a genocide.
Well, Andrei Markovits, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrei Markovits, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the White House's plans to rein in the predatory payday loan industry.
Goodbye. I learned a good way. Good way. I learned a good way. everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as the chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
It's always a privilege to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Bart. And the federal regulators are going to take up the payday loan industry and curb their incredibly predatory practices. Already, critics are saying they're not going far enough. And, of course, defenders, I don't know how anybody can defend these predatory practices of these bottom feeders, but they're saying, well, it's the only place where poor people can go to get loans to cover temporary emergencies. So where do you come down on today's move by the White House?
Good first step. Loopholes that need to be plugged to make sure this complete embarrassment of an industry is truly reformed. Let me begin with the public service advertisement. A bunch of decades ago, the founder of my organization wrote Unsafe at Any Speed about the automobile industry. About a decade ago, a Harvard professor wrote a similar treatise about financial products called Unsafe at Any Rate, a clear homage to Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed. And that treatise was the foundation of what is called today the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So we're very proud to be sort of the foundation of Senator Warren's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which in fact takes up half the name of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. They have been the bright star in Wall Street reform so far. With this particular proposal, and it's 1,000 pages long, they take an important step in principle by saying something that is so obvious, namely that a lender should only loan to people that can repay. And again, I mean, who can disagree with that? But in fact, the business model of too many of these loan sharks is to trap somebody who is really not capable of repaying. And in so many cases, and I know firsthand some of these cases, it's tear-jerking, that are so unsophisticated and shouldn't be allowed to take out these loans and trap them in debt, and they're charged as much as they can possibly repay before they are just sucked dry. So the CFPB is proposing to try to fix that. The reason that we're not celebrating as loudly as we might is that they do have exemptions for certain levels of loan above, you know, below a certain value, a certain type of loan. And I'm a little concerned that they are testing how bad the lawsuits are going to be or how fierce the lobby is going to be, because, of course, in the Republican-controlled Congress, even in some Democrats, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, one of the leaders of the Democratic Party, are in the employ of the loan shark industry.
Well, it would seem that that's pretty shameful to begin with, that Congress people support these bottom feeders. But it's been pretty clear from day one that the Republicans have done everything they can to shut down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which Senator Elizabeth Warren was the founder of. I mean, they've just waged war against it. So
yes.
I'd like to see these people justify why they're doing it. I mean, clearly they're just getting paid off by the lobbyists
right. That
represent
them. I think they should be required, like a NASCAR driver, to wear their sponsors' labels on their uniforms so it would show the names of the payday you know, the logos of the payday lenders that are their suppliers when they sit up on the dais during a congressional hearing. Because if the American public paid any attention to these congressional hearings where they are these congresspersons, mostly Republican, but unfortunately a lot of Democrats, are shilling for these loan sharks, it is so embarrassing. It's beyond embarrassing. It is shameful.
And again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's a financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Well, I mean, first of all, the interest rates that these payday lenders charge are an annual percentage rate of 391%. The mafia doesn't charge that much.
Yeah. No, so I taught math, and I, you know, this is, these are fabulous numbers. We dealt with this one woman in Portland, Oregon. She has cancer. I think she has early onset Alzheimer's. She is not somebody who is particularly astute about finance. And she took out a $500 payday loan to pay a medical bill, and they sent her a bill for $4,000. And we can't even figure out, just tell us the math. And it's gone to a court where she declared bankruptcy. But the judge, because part of this payday loan includes a mandatory arbitration clause, and I'll explain that in a second, means that she can't even declare bankruptcy. She has to submit to mandatory arbitration, where some person selected by industry essentially will arbitrate just how much she owes. It may not be $40,000, it'll be $30,000, but they pick a number that will just bleed her of every last possible possession she has. And it's pathetic.
So why do you think it is so protected? Is it simply just that they spend, that they make so much money, they spend enough on lobbying?
Yes.
I'd heard somewhere that some of the big banks wanted to get in on the action and form subsidiaries. I mean, is this, it's so extraordinary. I mean, yes, on Tuesday there was a meltdown press conference that Donald Trump did where he was smoked out on Trump University, which was a flim-flam scam. And on Wednesday, they actually insulted the judge, which was insane, to provoke a federal judge. And that gives you an idea of the sort of predatory nature of so much of American business, and it's perfectly accepted. You know, after all, he's the standard-bearer of the Republican Party at the moment. So how did we get to a situation where loan sharks that are more unscrupulous and more ruthless than the mafia get dignified by big business and by businessmen, practices businessmen like Donald Trump, who are hardly being held to account?
Well, it all goes back to issue number one, which is we have a cash and carry Congress. And if you're making a huge amount of money and it depends on the graces of government, you're rationally going to spend whatever it takes to protect your racket. And that means giving money to congressmen for their reelection. It depends on Americans being relatively less interested in this area. You know, one problem with being an underdog is that you don't tend to have a lobbyist. And so those of us who are privileged enough to have a relatively stable income care about certain things, but we don't particularly care about this. And I mean, we care about important issues, but we don't really care or cause our congressman to be elected or not elected based on this. And meanwhile, he's fattening his campaign coffers with this loan shark money. And, you know, he responds or she responds with the appropriate legislation or blocking the legislation. Unfortunately, again, we have a cash and carry Congress.
But there seems to be an attitude out there that if people are dumb enough to take out these loans, then it's their problem. I mean, there seems to be a certain level of contempt. I know Donald Trump recently said he loves the poorly educated voters. I mean, these people who take out these loans don't have the financial sophistication to know that they're getting hosed. And the payday lenders, no sooner have they given them a loan, they call them up and and talk them into rolling the loan over and getting even more money. And of course, that cycle gets them to the point where they're in debt from which they can never escape. And a lot of this is just preying on the poor. It's that simple.
One of my friends is my counterpart at Cato. He is a person of good faith. He's an intelligent guy. He's a libertarian. I am pretty much the opposite of a libertarian. And I normally think that some of the things he says are rational, and he makes a good point. On this one, and he is, you know, complaining about this rule, I'm going to have to confront him because, listen, you can't tell my early onset Alzheimer's aunt that who's too proud to get a loan from her nephew, her otherwise willing nephew, that she needs to, you know, expose herself to the hurly-burly of the loan shark. There needs to be some basic protection. And all the CFPB is saying is that a loan shark, a payday lender, needs to make sure that who they're lending to can pay them back. Is that really a breach of, is that really the nanny state? I think that's fundamental.
Yeah, but is it enforceable? I mean, a lot of critics are saying that these rules aren't tough enough.
Okay, well, then we're going to my complaint about the rule, and that is it is not tough enough. And I wish my Cato friend Mark Calabria would join me at least at the basic principle that they ought to be able to repay, and they ought to be at least making an informed choice as opposed to what I would call an uninformed choice. But yes, the CFPB then, once they adopt that principle, should say, let's enforce it. Let's really say, you know, for some people, a $300 loan, they can't repay. And, you know, they talk about medical emergencies. So I have two kids in medicine. Nobody gets turned away from the emergency room. They don't say, you know, let's do a credit check on you before we, you know, sew your chest back up from that gunshot wound. They're going to be taken care of. Your car breaks down and you can't afford it. Well, the last place you should look is a loan shark, because you've got to hit up your nephew, you know, because eventually you're going to have to hit up your nephew even if you do take a loan shark loan, because the loan shark's going to be after you. So I'm sorry, Ian, I'm frustrated with this.
I understand. I know. I've always, this and the other racket in Washington, the for-profit college racket, I often cite them as examples of how corrupt and bought our Congress is at the tawdriest level. I mean, you know, these, as I say, these are the bottom feeders of capitalism. And the idea that you could look yourself in the mirror and take their money and protect these people to go out and rip off the least among us, the poorest among us, the people who are in desperation, take out these loans. And after all, these payday lending operations are in just about every storefront of every mini mall around the country. It's like they're
more than McDonald's, and it is a racket.
You could take a breath here and not get too upset. The one bit of good The one bit of good news is that General Petraeus's wife Holly managed to, because she's got some, you know, the credibility of the military behind her and Congressman Walter Jones and a bunch of, you know, the few decent people in the House.
Sure.
They, I think, got a law through that meant the payday lenders couldn't literally be right on military bases or just outside military bases. They moved them back about 5 miles or something.
You know?
But that, again, that's like the for-profit colleges. They prey on the vets. They prey on people in the service, you know, and if you're out there getting shot at in Iraq or Afghanistan, you don't want to be worrying about whether, you know, the house is going to be foreclosed on, you know?
Yep. I thought you couldn't fall off the floor, but apparently with payday lending, you can.
So let's then proceed with where this is going now, these new rules. You say it's a big 1,000-page document dump. Can we have an open vote on it? Can we really expose?
The public is invited to comment. There is a whole bunch of jiu-jitsu that's likely to take place during the following several months. This is open for public comment. Your listeners are welcome, invited to comment. CFPB.gov. If they go on that website, they'll find the actual link. Anybody can comment. Conservatives, libertarians, vegetarians, octogenarians are invited to comment. The comments have to be considered by the CFPB. The more comments from people that ask for reform, the more weight that the CFPB will have. It probably will be subject to litigation from the bad guys. I mean, if you're making whatever it is, $8, $10 billion off this loan shark interest rates, you're likely to spend the couple hundred thousand or $1 million in a lawsuit. The lawsuit is likely to address a number of issues, such as the ability of the statutory authority of the CFPB to do what it's doing. Also, the cost benefit. In other words, how much lenders are suffering, how much borrowers are suffering, and therefore the comment is important and for the robustness, the muscularity of that legal case. I can predict what lawyer they will choose, namely Eugene Scalia of Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, and yes, he is the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. It is possible this rule will not be finalized in the Obama administration. There is an obscure thing called the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to overturn any rule, and there is a 60-day window period in which they have to do that, and the president then vetoes it. So we're actually beyond the 60 legislative days, and there are probably not 60 legislative days. So this is likely to have to be, if the rule goes final, and we're in a proposed rule stage, if the rule goes final, I'll just guesstimate, November or October, then the Congress has 60 legislative days, which could spill into the year 2017. So it is the next president that would be required to override the veto. So when you vote for president, you are voting on this rule. In other words, if it is the Republican president, I really don't know if the presumptive nominee Donald Trump would veto this. The founder of Trump University, I would have to guess he might, or if it will be Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, presumably would override it. So The presidential election will determine the existence of this rule, to cut to the chase.
Right. Well, just in closing, though, important statistics. The payday loan industry is a $38 billion industry, and 12 million Americans take up payday loans each year. So there's a lot of money out there, a lot of people are being ripped off, and a Congress that is shamefully protecting the bad guys. So we'll follow this up, follow this story, and I thank you for joining us, Bartlett Naylor.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policy where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Whoa.